Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro.
I'm Alicia Garcia Herrero.
And today we will discuss China's relations with Japan and what they mean for Europe. This episode is part of Bruegel's focus on global China as seen from Europe, which includes our monthly newsletter, Zhongguan Mundus, to which we invite you to subscribe. The link is in the show notes. Joining our conversation today is Yoshikazu Kato, who is director of the Trans-Pacific Group Institute and research fellow at the Rakuten Securities Economic Research Institute. Hello, Kato-san. How are you?
Hello. Thank you for having me. It's a great honor to join the program.
It's a great honor for us. You are based in Tokyo, correct?
Tokyo, yes, correct.
That's great. First of all, I would like to start this conversation by reviewing the reality and prospect of Japan-China relations. 2022 is marking the 50th anniversary since the diplomatic normalization between the two countries, and the anniversary comes in between the Olympic hosting of Tokyo last year and Beijing Winter Olympics this year. Beijing has faced diplomatic pressures from the West on the issue. How Japan, the ally, and the US would manage the issue as a neighbor in such an important year for the relationship is only one of the issues on the table. Can you perhaps explain our listeners where do we stand in these relations and how did we got there?
Yes, thank you for your question. You described very well, and I think Japan-China relations is quite important, obviously. China is the second largest economy in the world, and Japan is the third largest. So, you know, Japan and China, as Asian countries, we need to be responsible for world peace and prosperity, and this is quite important. And now, as you mentioned, 2022 is a very important year as well, and because Japan and China mark 50th anniversary since the diplomatic normalization. So this is quite important. And this year, Japan held the Tokyo Olympics game. And due to the COVID-19, we postponed a year. And actually, only after a half year, Beijing is going to hold the Olympic game. So like Beijing's authorities said, you know, Japan and China should support each other in terms of, you know, holding Olympics game. This is politically important for bilateral relationship. This is the context or rhetoric by Beijing. And Japan basically understands that. And, you know, we want to support Beijing and we want to maintain a good relationship between Japan and China. But as you mentioned, Japan has been the ally of the United States. And now looking at US-China relations, actually quite complicated. You know, they are facing a lot of problems like economics, you know, high tech, military, human rights. And as you know, Biden administration already, you know, announced the diplomatic boycott on Beijing Olympics game. And, you know, Australia, UK, some countries from Five Eyes, they are following. So now people are concerned about how Japan should manage the issue. On the one hand, next year would be quite important for Japan-China relationship. And at the same time, you know, we need to, you know, respect the integrity in the West. Like, you know, G7 released announcement, just Hong Kong ended the legislative election, and actually G7 announced some, you know, statement and expressed a grave concern on Hong Kong's human rights issue and freedom issue. And Japan has to coordinate that as a part of Western country. But at the same time, we are located in Asia. So this is a quite complicated and challenging issue for Japan. So next year would be quite critical for Japan, how to manage the relationship with China, at the same time not going to hurt our relation with the United States, and how to strengthen and maintain our integrity among the Western countries. And this is quite important. And of course, the European countries are a part of that. So, you know, it's a very critical time to focus and discuss.
If I may have a follow-up question to what you just said, from the situation that you're describing about the special position of Japan within the global frame and also the regional frame, would you see Japan as somehow in the middle of many of those configurations which are at the center of the big politics of the 22nd century at the moment? How would you define that?
Yeah, this is a great point. Historically speaking, since the end of the World War II, Japan was occupied by the United States, right? And then the United States drafted our constitution. We say pacifist, peaceful constitution. And actually, we are not allowed to possess our own military. So we need to engage in the international issues peacefully without any military capability. So Japan has been a very unique country since the end of World War II. We do not have our own military. Our security should have relied on US-Japan alliance. That is why allies with the United States is always top priority for Japan. And we have democracy, unlike a lot of Asian countries. But we are Asia, and we have some Confucius, you know, tradition. So between Japan and China, we have a lot of common language, including kanji characters, right? So, you know, culturally speaking, Japan obviously is a part of Asia, even East Asia. But in terms of political system or, you know, international position, we are a part of the West. But now Asia is emerging in terms of economy. And, you know, Obama administration said the rebalancing policy or pivot policy, you know, in terms of Indo-Pacific today. So now a lot of countries, including the United States and European countries, they are focusing on Asia. So in this situation, which kind of roles Japan can play? This is maybe a new question. I think because we do not have our own military, so I would say Japan is impossible to become a major power. It's impossible. Unlike US, unlike China, unlike Russia, it is impossible for Japan to pursue so-called major power because we do not have military capability. But economically, or some companies, or our culture, or soft power, you know, we can, you know, contribute our own capability. So I think it's a kind of bridge between the West and the East, make a bridge between China and the United States, because we have democracy. We know how democracy or freedom is important and relevant for Western countries. But at the same time, we need to survive. For us, it is impossible to neglect the huge market of China. Economic ties is relevant. So we need to learn how to take balance. So for Japan, how to take balance is an important issue. How to take balance between politics and economy, human rights and market, the United States and China. So we need to pursue our own position. But I think the basic concept would be we have to make a bridge, make a peaceful bridge beyond the continent, including EU.
Alicia, I'm looking at you because what Kato-san just said, how to take a balance, strikes, I think, a chord also for us as Europeans in this debate at the moment, right?
Absolutely. And I think Kato-san mentioned something which is very similar for Europe, although not to the same degree. But Europe itself doesn't have the military power that either China or the US have. And this is also, you know, a lesson from history to some extent, and also the fact that we were relying on the US. This is, of course, NATO. And in a way, Japan is going in that direction with Quad and the Indo-Pacific strategy more generally. So in a way, I mean, we're not so far. The difference is, of course, we're not sitting in Asia. So in that regard, I think even if China is an important market for Europe, it isn't as important as it is for Japan because we have our own internal market. And in terms of the pendulum, if I may say, because of our origin, you know, Western civilization with very different, you mentioned Confucian values, in a way, we are similar to Japan, but we're closer in a way, whether culturally or even military. Maybe not military, but in as far as NATO has been there for longer, perhaps we could say even military, to the US. I mean, we suffer from great power competition, but we aren't one of those great powers, at least militarily speaking. I think it's very important to learn from Japan, and that's why we're having this conversation, basically.
Indeed. It would be interesting to know a little bit more from Kato-san how Europe is perceived from Japan, of course, but within this sort of triangle, how this triangle between Europe, Japan, and China could be further conceptualized in the current configuration that Alicia just mentioned.
Sure. I think Europe and Asia, or maybe more concretely speaking, for example, Germany and France, and Japan and China, we have had a lot of similar experiences, common memories. So that is why we need to, you know, learn to each other. And Europe has experienced a lot of wars, you know, military confrontation, how to overcome the side effect of war, or, unlucky or unhappy history. And then, you know, European countries has, you know, gradually, you know, realized the unification process. And of course, I remember a couple of years ago, you know, Asian countries, including Japan, China, we have talked about East Asian community, even Asian Union. But, you know, obviously we are listening to how European countries saying and doing. So this is very good comparison. That is why always Japan and China, respectively, from different perspective, we are talking Europe. European experience is quite important for Asia, for us, but maybe slightly different motivations or, you know, definition. Because Japan and most of the European countries, we have shared our common values, right? Universal values, you know, human rights is matter. Of course, economic interests is quite important, but looking at today's EU's policy toward China, you have made a point of EU-China investment treaty that took more than 7 years negotiation between the two sides. But now, due to some human rights issue, basically are suspended. This means that from Japan's perspective, human rights matters for Europe. Even it sacrifices some economic interests. So European countries, even EU, should take balance how to deal with economic interests, China's huge market, and human rights issue. So this is always complicated. And Japan understands that very much. Japan has positioned very similar situation in terms of this balancing issue. I mean, similar with European countries, because China has been the largest trading partner for Japan. And maybe EU and Japan has different understanding and definition on human rights. Because, you know, I would say I am from Asia and Asia is East. So Japan, culturally speaking, we are Eastern country, not Western. But that is why I think we have had different understanding on human rights, but human rights matters for Japan as well. So I think EU and Japan, we should strengthen the conversation on that, how to deal with China, how to communicate with China. China is rising up very rapidly, but without a certain term of transparency. So we are always confused. What is Chinese leaders, Chinese authority thinking about? They say common prosperity. They say they are going to double their GDP until 2035. But what is your purpose? Is it economic rights or more, you know, comprehensive? Are you going to maintain your own political system? Or are you going to converge your ideology with the rest of the world? What is your intention? This should be cultivated. This should be discussed between Japan and EU. Right. So I think European countries, obviously, you are perceived by Japan, China, quite important differently. But we have a lot of, you know, comparative topics should be cultivated. But my point is, first of all, because I am from Japan, Japan and EU should strengthen a conversation on how to deal with China, how to understand China, what is China's intention, how different compared to a decade ago, 2 decades ago. Because China is standing on the different position. This is historic. This is a historic transformation. So hopefully, you know, a conversation like today could provide some implications.
Thank you, Kato-san, for this. A couple of things from my side. I understand the different point of view, and that's perfectly fine. However, as much as we can discuss where China is heading, I guess, you know, China is telling us where China is heading. Yeah, I mean, I don't think there is a doubt that China has no intention to converge with our political system, which, by the way, is both Japan's and Europe's. And if we focus here on the economics of what this means, is that we'll need to struggle, basically, with that divergence in political systems and accept it because we can't do much about it. If we now focus on the market, and that's basically what we have in common, the degree of acceptance might be slightly different because of the cultural differences you mentioned. But let's put that aside for a second. Let's think about the market, China's market. I think both for Japan and Europe, the real question is how much of that market is China willing to share? And second question is, what can we do about it? So meaning, even if we reframe from political considerations and we focus on a very simple matter, you said China's market is humongous. So, you know, there's nothing to question about that. You didn't say that, but I mean, implicitly. Now I would argue, well, what if that market isn't shared? Yeah. And we've been seeing some decisions by China lately, whether it's dual circulation and several others that could test to think that that might be direction in which China is heading. So what can Japan do so that we learn from Japan? That's really my question. And also, is there anything we can do in common to at least prepare for that potential outcome? We're not sure, but you know, we should prepare for this. What could we do?
Thank you, Alicia, for your question. I got your point. And I agree. We need to accept the reality, a new normal. Yes, China's political system is different. Ideology is different, but there is a huge market. And both for Europe and Japan, we are not going to abandon that market. That is why we need to face it and tackle it. I think there is a common sense in Japan's business community. That is why, like Toyota, big firms, now they already decided, you know, we increase the investment in China, particularly in manufacturing, you know, even insurance company. We say monozukuri, you know, the manufacturing industries, you know, mainly they say we continue to focus on China and even increase our investment. That means that China's economy is going up, even though they would experience some, you know, up and down, or some volatility, or some untransparency. And now, obviously, in China's market, a nature of market are shifting dramatically. Very simply speaking, from Deng Xiaoping's era to Xi Jinping's era. In Deng Xiaoping's era, you know, there are a lot of things, business, deal, that could be done based on market mechanism, even, you know, very loose control from the government. But now Xi Jinping is standing up. He is going to strengthen their control, tightening their control on market. You need to listen to us. We have our own rule. We have our own law, right? So that is why, you know, you are a Chinese company or joint ventures or, you know, foreign firms, you have to respect our law, our principles. Otherwise, you have no market here. You are earning money from Chinese market. That is why you have to, even you have to respect our political interests, political core interest. This is how China plays politics and economy. And actually, Japanese companies know it very well. That is why a Japanese company is not going to cross the red line. They do not touch politics. But because of the huge attractiveness of Chinese market, there is no chance for them to neglect or abandon Chinese market. So I think this is a time to very clearly focus on what is pros and cons, what is chances, what is risks of China. Maybe risks would be maybe from Japan-China relations, because Japanese investors, Japanese companies, they are very nervous on Japan-China relationship. For example, our territory issue or a historic issue. If some, you know, anti-Japanese sentiments are rising up in China, that means a huge damage for Japanese companies. That is why they care about politics. But they hope politics does not interfere with economic ties. That is why they hope our government could manage the relation with China very carefully and stably. So this is, I think, their common voice from business side to political side. So there is some, you know, common sense and common language among business community. And I think there is some similarity in terms of relationship between EU and China. Economy and trade is important. That is why, you know, a lot of companies, including from Germany, right, increase their investment in China. They believe or they assess, even though some up and down, but China will grow gradually, dramatically. But, you know, politically, China is shifting dramatically as well. Different relationship between government and market, politics and economy. So I would say, back to a couple of decades ago, even back to Hu Jintao's administration, that looked like capitalism. That looked like market-oriented. That is a we can talk, we can deal. But now we should face and understand, now China is entering a different stage. This is a kind of more socialism, less market-oriented. This is quite important. I think back to Mao Zedong's era, that is completely socialism, no capitalism, no market economy, because that copied the Soviet Union's model. And since Deng Xiaoping launched the reform and opening up policy, late 1970s, to I think until 2010 or 2012, I think China basically pursued socialism, but marketing economy. They know marketing economy is quite important for the economy, but now different. Now it's a kind of more socialism, less marketing economy. But this doesn't mean market economy is disappearing. No, they need to rely on economy. That is why market is relevant. But socialism plays more dominant role on market or in market. So this is a new normal for us. So we need to accept and adjust a new normal. And this is a common challenge for EU and Japanese companies.
Thank you, Kato-san. This is a very interesting perspective of some of the discussions we usually have with Alicia in this podcast, also with other experts. And it brings another view, you know, having this perspective from Japan. I wanted to perhaps zoom in a bit more on this triangulation, EU, Japan, China triangle, because we've discussed quite a lot about the China market and China economy and politics changing within this frame, but perhaps something more geopolitical scenarios that we have, the global challenges that we have. I mean, how this is included within a frame where the US is acting in a certain way, where the rest of Asia as well is becoming an actor in a way or another, where the concept of Indo-Pacific, which was a concept that in Europe we didn't even thought about it. Trump reused it in a way that was clearly with an anti-China taste. So EU's policy towards Asia as well is adapting, you know, not only to the China changing and switch that you just mentioned between the two eras, but also is adapting to the regional situation. Maybe you could tell our listeners a bit more about how Japan is positioning itself within this regional context. It can be also interesting to delve a little bit more into this Indo-Pacific concept and what it means for Japan and what it can mean for Europe. And I would like to hear both from you and from Alicia a bit more about that.
Yes, thank you. I think a key word would be disparity. I think now I am concerned how European countries or European unions are integrated or unified. I can see some division, I mean, you know, divided, even among G7 countries, right? So how the G7 country, of course, you know, just after Hong Kong's legislative election, G7 foreign ministers announced a statement, you know, expressed a concern on Hong Kong's, you know, human rights issue and political freedom. So we have a lot of, you know, common sense and common principle. But when it comes to how to deal with China, how to manage the relationship between human rights issue and economic ties on China, I think even among G7 countries, we are divided. Italy, Germany, France, Japan, Canada, UK, particularly since the Brexit, how European countries or EU are integrated or united. So I think now the situation is getting more complicated. But you mentioned the triangle, the trilateral relationship among the three, right? I think Japan-EU relationship is relatively simple. You know, we have shared, you know, values and democracy, and we have faced a lot of common challenges, including climate change, Iran, or, you know, some terrorism issue, even migration issues, you know, Japan is facing as well. So I think in Japan, EU, we do not have to, you know, compete to each other. More conversation is necessary. But when it comes to dealing with China, maybe Japan and EU, we would have different understanding on human rights, because Japan and China are neighbors. Even though, you know, we are Eurasia countries, but there is a distance. So Japan-EU relationship and Japan-China relationships are completely different. So I think this is quite a new topic, you know, the trilateral relationship among the three, EU, Japan, China. But you mentioned Indo-Pacific. Now, after the Brexit, UK already said we are applying for joining CPTPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, right? But, you know, only UK. After the Brexit. So I would say now the United Kingdom is quite interested in engaging in Indo-Pacific. But looking at Japan's position, Biden administration said the United States is an Indo-Pacific nation, but Japan has never said that. We understand and we make a point of Indo-Pacific, and we have our own Indo-Pacific strategy, but we have never said we are Indo-Pacific nation. Why? Because we do not want to provoke China. Because from the perspective of China, Indo-Pacific is just enclosing China. This is against China. This is to contain the rise of China. And Japan is very, very carefully dealing with this issue. And in my understanding, as far as I know, a lot of European countries, including, you know, Belgium, you know, Germany, France, you have not said we are Indo-Pacific countries or something like that. So I think how to deal with this region in the context of the rise of China, we have slightly but explicitly different understanding and definition of who you are. How are you going to engage in this era, in this region? And I think now this is just kicking off. I do not think the trilateral relationship are mature, no. Because we have never had our so-called, you know, meeting, summit among EU's leaders, Japanese leader and Chinese leader. No, we have never had that. Only in the occasion of G7, G20, or international events. So I think now maybe this is a time to set up the trilateral summit, EU nations and the high representative by EU and Japan, China. Our leaders can sit down together and talk our common interests. I think there are a lot of common issues like climate change, and we need to clarify which areas would be competitive, which area would be confrontational, which area could be cooperative. Maybe climate change, this should be our common challenge. So basically, there are no disputes. We should be responsible for that. But when it comes to some, you know, for example, how to deal with Russia, quite sensitive, right? Iran, what's going on? North Korea, is European country interested in North Korea issue, nuclear issue? So I think we have some common interests. Even we have some core interests could be shared. So I think now our three parties, we need to clarify and categorize which areas could be, you know, working together, which areas should be untouchable, you know. So this is a time to talk about that. We need to face the importance of the triangle. And of course, we should not neglect the impact of the United States. Because for EU, for Japan, you have NATO, and Japan, US, we are allies. So we have, you know, different position. So hopefully we can manage the relation with China stably without undermining the relation with the US. And at the end of the day, if EU and Japan can work together and convince two major powers, China and the United States, to sit down and talk, behave peacefully, then this is, I think, a good start or, you know, good picture for future relationship. This is my point.
Sorry, if I may.
Yes, please.
For our listeners, Kato-san, because we've known each other for a long time, I have to say that I don't think the Indo-Pacific is a strange concept to Japan. It actually was introduced by Prime Minister Abe in 2016, before the US even talked about it. If I may, it was actually the US who copied down this concept from Japan.
You are right. Our interpretations is not contradictory. I mean, yes, you're right. Abe, prior to the United States, he said, you know, Indo-Pacific strategy is quite important. But what I said is Japan has never said we are Indo-Pacific nation.
Okay. I understand that. But my point really was more about Japan looking out for alliances and in the light of a stronger China. I don't want to say aggressive because I don't know how aggressive it is. I mean, that's a word that I don't like to use. Stronger China. And how that strength is used is something that probably Prime Minister Abe and others in Japan think is a question mark. And because it's a question mark, to put it very nicely, the free and open Indo-Pacific is of course, issues on the South China Sea. But let's forget about, even if nothing were happening, okay, a nation of the size of China right there, you know, close to your borders, is, of course, an issue for any nation. as it is for Japan. And the proof of the pudding is really, as I said, Prime Minister Abe's call for a free and open Indo-Pacific. Now, just to put our listeners in where we stand, after the UK explored participation, and by the way, we were together at Rasdina's, you remember, summit, where the UK made this point very clearly, France followed through. And then, you know, we actually had the Netherlands and then Germany, and now we actually have an EU-level Indo-Pacific strategy. As you rightly point out, no European nation is the Indo-Pacific nation for obvious reasons. But they do come to the forefront of the need to have a common positions on certain issues. And you mentioned some of them, which are very important, and that I agree maybe Europeans don't have as close in mind as Japanese, whether it's North Korea or others. But I would say this is really about free navigation. I mean, what pushes France and others is really free navigation, and independently, as I said, of the meaning of the word strong China. Let's not get into that. But this brings me to what I am, because I'm an economist. Free navigation is also about free market, about free trade, about global value chains. And in that regard, Japan, again, before anybody else, took a decision at the very beginning of COVID, right at the beginning of COVID, to introduce financial support to companies that would be willing to reshuffle the value chain for critical inputs, which were mainly on the domain of health matters, whether it was masks or other at the time, but basically critical inputs to the value chain. And this is something that has been discussed in Europe. So, you know, what I'm trying to say here is that I love the Japanese way to do things. I mean, on the principle, there is full acceptance of China's rise and you see the market part of it. But on the other hand, slowly, calmly, and quietly, you come with concepts such as the free navigation or the reshuffling of the value chain for critical supplies. So it's a very subtle way, which I hope Europeans could do as subtly as Japan does. And that's why I wanted to bring these things to the forefront.
Yes, thank you, Alicia. Let me respond a little bit. I think Japan, from politicians to the government official, I mean bureaucrats, to business community, now there is a concept, economic security, including supply chain. Taiwan TSMC started invested in Japan, increased their investment in Japan. So, you know, now we are witnessing some decoupling between US and China and how Japan survives in between. We have our own, you know, relationship with the United States, but most of the companies, I mean, in Japan, they have investments, they have factories in China, and they are using Xinjiang's materials to make their products. That is why, you know, now we are getting involved in this US-China competition. So in this very complicated era, you know, as you said, we need to make sure which kind of areas we should maintain our principle, and which kind of areas we can compromise. And we need to clarify these issues very clearly and seriously. So this is quite important. So I think Japan, we know now, you know, our era is changing dramatically. We need to adjust it. We shouldn't be conservative. I agree, you know, we shouldn't use, you know, aggressiveness, but sometimes Japan should learn how to express our own concerns toward China. And I think this is quite important for the rise of China. China needs healthy pressure from the outside. I think external pressure always matters for China. If, you know, nobody say no to China, this is a real risk for China. As they say, you know, China is still a developing country, so a lot of things to do. That is why, you know, we, Japan, US, or European countries, we need to update how to deal with China. What should we say? What should we do? In this regard, I think now it's a good time because China is going to hold the Beijing Olympics game. If you survive and emerge here, you need to do something good. You need to learn how to coexist with the rest of the world. You cannot resolve everything economically. You're using money. No, we are human beings, society. A lot of complicated issues, including human rights. So I think this is a very good time to convince China, if you are ready to coexist with us in this complicated era, you need to do something. You shouldn't do something including on human rights issue, you know, economic abuse, you know, a lot of issues, you need to adjust the rule and value-based international order unless you are going to create a different era, unless you are going to break, you know, everything. I do not think China is going to do that. If so, you have to adjust, you have to respect. So this is our role, common role, because EU and Japan are relatively big countries, and we have some capacity to convince China, unlike some very small countries. They are not going to do that. But we have responsibility to do that, to let China know who you are, where you are. Don't misjudge yourself. You are China, right? So this is our maybe our common responsibility.
Thank you so much, Kato-san and Alicia. I think that we are going towards the end of these episodes. However, I have to say that we could go on for a couple of more hours discussing these issues, because those are key. I mean, as you say, Kato-san, there are some issues that you touch upon, that some of them, they just go on the economic side and the political side, but others go really on, let me use this expression, the long march of history. We are clearly at a pivotal moment on the history of global relations. And those issues that we touched upon today on the relations between Japan, China, and the EU, in reality, are part of this bigger story that is unfolding under our eyes. And this is one of our first podcasts of 2022. And we're going to keep looking during the year with Alicia in the frame of our Zhonghua Mundus series on what is going to be important to watch on this space, but also more broadly at the Sound of Economics. We are going to keep an eye on all these issues, on the different aspects that are connected, you know, also sometimes things that don't really deal geopolitically with Asia or with Japan and China, but they interconnect and intersect. So thank you so much for this conversation today. And for joining us from Tokyo, thanks a lot. And this brings us to the end of this episode, which was part of Bruegel's focus on global China as seen from Europe, which includes as well a monthly newsletter, Zhonghua Mundus, to which we invite you to subscribe. The link is in the show notes. As usual, you can read in open access all the analysis by our scholars and our experts on our website, www.bruegel.org. Kato-san, Alicia, thanks a lot again for joining this conversation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
And thanks to our listeners for following us. Until next time, bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye, Kato-san. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.